Dune by Frank Herbert, continued. Shrill cheers rained from the galleries.
They cheer me now, Fade Rotha thought.
He heard the wildness in the voices just as Howitt had said he would. They'd never cheered a family fighter that way before. And he thought with an edge of grimness on a thing Howitt had told him.
It's easier to be terrified by an enemy you admire.
Swiftly, Fade Rotha retreated to the center of the arena where all could see clearly. He drew his long blade, crouched, and waited for the advancing slave. The man took only the time to lash the second barb tight to his arm, then sped in pursuit.
Let the family see me do this thing, Fade Rotha thought. I am their enemy. Let them think of me as they see me now.
He drew his short blade.
I do not fear you, Harkonnen swine, the gladiator said. Your tortures cannot hurt a dead man. I can be dead on my own blade before a handler lays finger to my flesh, and I'll have you dead beside me.
Fade Rotha grinned, offered now the long blade, the one with the poison.
Try this one, he said,
and feinted with the short blade in his other hand. The slave shifted knife hands, turned inside both parry and feint to grapple the Na Baron's short blade, the one in the white-gloved hand that tradition said should carry the poison.
You will die, Harkonnen, the gladiator gasped.
They struggled sideways across the sand. Where Fade Rotha's shield met the slave's half-shield, a blue glow marked the contact. The air around them filled with ozone from the field.
Die on your own poison, the slave grated.
He began forcing the white-gloved hand inward, turning the blade he thought carried the poison.
Let them see this, Fade Rotha thought.
He brought down the long blade, felt it clang uselessly against the barbed shaft lashed to the slave's arm. Fade Rotha felt a moment of desperation. He had not thought the barbed shafts would be an advantage for the slave, but they gave the man another shield. And the strength of this gladiator! The short blade was being forced inward inexorably, and Fade Rotha focused on the fact that a man could also die on an unpoisoned blade.
Scum!
Fade Rotha gasped. At the key word, the gladiator's muscles obeyed with a momentary slackness. It was enough for Fade Rotha. He opened a space between them sufficient for the long blade. Its poison tip flicked out, drew a red line down the slave's chest. There was instant agony in the poison. The man disengaged himself, staggered backward.
Now let my dear family watch, Fade Rotha thought. Let them think on this slave who tried to turn the knife he thought poisoned and use it against me. Let them wonder how a gladiator could come into this arena ready for such an attempt. And let them always be aware they cannot know for sure which of my hands carries the poison.
Fade Rotha stood in silence, watching the slowed motions of the slave. The man moved within a hesitation awareness. There was an orthographic thing on his face now for every watcher to recognize. The death was written there. The slave knew it had been done to him, and he knew how it had been done. The wrong blade had carried the poison.
You!
The man moaned. Fade Rotha drew back to give death its space. The paralyzing drug in the poison had yet to take full effect, but the man's slowness told of its advance. The slave staggered forward as though drawn by a string, one dragging step at a time. Each step was the only step in his universe. He still clutched his knife, but its point wavered.
One day, one of us will get you, he gasped.
A sad little moo contorted his mouth. He sat, sagged, then stiffened and rolled away from Fade Rotha, face down. Fade Rotha advanced in the silent arena, put a toe under the gladiator, and rolled him onto his back to give the galleries a clear view of the face when the poison began its twisting, wrenching work on the muscles. But the gladiator came over with his own knife protruding from his breast. In spite of frustration, there was for Fade Rotha a measure of admiration for the effort this slave had managed in overcoming the paralysis to do this thing to himself. With the admiration came the realization that here was truly a thing to fear.
That which makes a man superhuman is terrifying.
As he focused on this thought, Fade Rotha became conscious of the eruption of noise from the stands and galleries around him. They were cheering with utter abandon. Fade Rotha turned, looking up at them. All were cheering except the Baron, who sat with hand to chin in deep contemplation, and the Count and his lady, both of whom were staring down at him, their faces masked by smiles. Count Fenring turned to his lady, said,
A resourceful, young man, my dear? His, synaptic responses are very swift, she said.
The Baron looked at her, at the Count, returned his attention to the arena, thinking,
If someone could get that close to one of mine!
Rage began to replace his fear.
I'll have the slave master dead over a slow fire this night, and if this count and his lady had a hand in it...
The conversation in the Baron's box was remote movement to Fade Rotha, the voices drowned in the foot-stamping chant that came now from all around.
Head! 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 Head!
The Baron scowled, seeing the way Fade Rotha turned to him. Languidly, controlling his rage with difficulty, the Baron waved his hand toward the young man standing in the arena beside the sprawled body of the slave.
Give the boy a head. He earned it by exposing the slave master.
Fade Rotha saw the signal of agreement, thought,
They think they honor me. Let them see what I think.
He saw his handlers approaching with a saw knife to do the honors, waved them back, repeated the gesture as they hesitated.
They think they honor me with just a head, he thought.
He bent and crossed the gladiator's hands around the protruding knife handle, then removed the knife and placed it in the limp hands. It was done in an instant, and he straightened, beckoned his handlers.
Bury the slave intact, with his knife in his hands, he said. The man earned it.
In the golden box, Count Fenring leaned close to the Baron, said,
A grand gesture, that. True bravura. Your nephew has style as well as courage. He insults the crowd by refusing the head, the Baron muttered.
Not at all,
Lady Fenring said. She turned, looking up at the tears around them. And the Baron noted the line of her neck, a truly lovely flowing of muscles, like a young boy's.
They like what your nephew did, she said.
As the import of Fade Rotha's gesture penetrated to the most distant seats, as the people saw the handlers carrying off the dead gladiator intact, the Baron watched them and realized she had interpreted the reaction correctly. The people were going wild, beating on each other, screaming and stamping. The Baron spoke wearily.
I shall have to order a fete. You cannot send people home like this, their energies unspent. They must see that I share their elation.
He gave a hand signal to his guard, and a servant above them dipped the Harkonnen orange pennant over the box. Once, twice, three times. Signal for a fete. Fade Rotha crossed the arena to stand beneath the golden box, his weapons sheathed, arms hanging at his sides. Above the undiminished frenzy of the crowd, he called,
A fete, uncle!
The noise began to subside as people saw the conversation and waited.
In your honor, Fade, the Baron called down,
and again he caused the pennant to be dipped in signal. Across the arena, the Prue barriers had been dropped, and young men were leaping down into the arena, racing toward Fade Rotha.
You ordered the Prue shields dropped, Baron?
The Count asked.
No one will harm the lad, the Baron said. He's a hero.
The first of the charging mass reached Fade Rotha, lifted him on their shoulders, began parading around the arena.
He could walk unarmed and unshielded through the poorest quarters of Harko tonight, the Baron said. They'd give him the last of their food and drink just for his company.
The Baron pushed himself from his chair, settled his weight into his suspensors.
You will forgive me, please. There are matters that require my immediate attention. The guard will see you to the keep.
The Count arose, bowed.
Certainly, Baron. We're looking forward to the fete. I've never seen a Harkonnen fete.
Yes, the Baron said. The fete.
He turned, was enveloped by guards as he stepped into the private exit from the box. A guard captain bowed to Count Fenring.
Your orders, my lord? We will, wait for the worst, crush to, pass,
the Count said.
Yes, my lord.
The man bowed himself back three paces. Count Fenring faced his lady, spoke again in their personal humming code tongue.
You saw it, of course.
In the same humming tongue, she said,
The lad knew the gladiator wouldn't be drugged. There was a moment of fear, yes, but no surprise.
It was planned, he said, the entire performance.
Without a doubt.
It stinks of Howitt.
Indeed, she said.
I demanded earlier that the Baron eliminate Howitt.
That was an error, my dear.
I see that now.
The Harkonnens may have a new Baron ere long.
If that's Howitt's plan.
That will bear examination, true, she said.
The young one will be more amenable to control.
For us, after tonight, she said.
You don't anticipate difficulty seducing him, my little brood mother?
No, my love. You saw how he looked at me.
Yes, and I can see now why we must have that bloodline.
Indeed, and it's obvious we must have a hold on him. I'll plant deep in his deepest self the necessary prana bindu phrases to bend him.
We'll leave as soon as possible, as soon as you're sure, he said.
She shuddered.
By all means, I should not want to bear a child in this terrible place.
The things we do in the name of humanity, he said.
Yours is the easy part, she said.
There are some ancient prejudices I overcome, he said. They're quite primordial, you know.
My poor dear, she said, and patted his cheek. You know this is the only way to be sure of saving that bloodline.
He spoke in a dry voice.
I quite understand what we do. We won't fail, she said.
Guilt starts as a feeling of failure, he reminded.
There'll be no guilt, she said. Hypnoligation of that fade Rotha's psyche and his child in my womb. Then we go.
That uncle, he said. Have you ever seen such distortion?
He's pretty fierce, she said. But the nephew could well grow to be worse.
Thanks to that uncle. You know, when you think what this lad could have been with some other upbringing, with the Atreides code to guide him, for example?
It's sad, she said.
Would that we could have saved both the Atreides youth and this one. From what I heard of that young Paul, a most admirable lad, good union of breeding and training. He shook his head. But we shouldn't waste sorrow over the aristocracy of misfortune.
There's a Bene Gesserit saying, she said.
You have sayings for everything, he protested.
You'll like this one, she said. It goes, do not count a human dead until you've seen his body, and even then you can make a mistake.
Muad'Dib tells us in A Time of Reflection that his first collisions with Arakeen necessities were the true beginnings of his education. He learned then how to pole the sand for its weather, learned the language of the wind's needles stinging his skin, learned how the gnolls can buzz with sand itch, and how to gather his body's precious moisture around him to guard it and preserve it. As his eyes assumed the blue of the Ibad, he learned the Chakopsa way. Stilgar's Preface to Muad'Dib the Man by the Princess Irulan. Stilgar's troop, returning to the seats with its two strays from the desert, climbed out of the basin in the waning light of the first moon. The robed figures hurried with the smell of home in their nostrils. Dawn's gray line behind them was brightest at the notch in their horizon calendar that marked the middle of autumn, the month of Caprock. Wind-raked dead leaves strewed the cliff base where the siege children had been gathering them, but the sounds of the troops' passage, except for occasional blunderings by Paul and his mother, could not be distinguished from the natural sounds of the night. Paul wiped sweat-caked dust from his forehead, felt a tug at his arm, heard Chani's voice hissing.
"Do as I told you. Bring the fold of your hood down over your forehead. Leave only the eyes exposed. You waste moisture."
A whispered command behind them demanded silence.
"The desert hears you!"
A bird chirruped from the rocks high above them. The troop stopped, and Paul sensed abrupt tension. There came a faint thumping from the rocks, a sound no louder than mice jumping in the sand. Again the bird chirruped. A stir passed through the troop's ranks, and again the mouse thumping pecked its way across the sand. Once more the bird chirruped. The troop resumed its climb up into a crack in the rocks, but there was a stillness of breath about the Fremen now that filled Paul with caution, and he noted covert glances toward Chani, the way she seemed to withdraw, pulling in upon herself. There was rock underfoot now, a faint gray swishing of robes around them, and Paul sensed a relaxing of discipline, but still that quiet of the person about Chani and the others. He followed a shadow shape, up steps, a turn, more steps, into a tunnel, past two moisture-sealed doors, and into a globe-lighted narrow passage with yellow rock walls and ceiling.